Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, makers, artists, writers, filmmakers, designers, and coders who are on a mission of bringing their ideas to life by creating new things and getting their work to work. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast, challenge your assumptions about what is possible, and chase big ideas so you can become who you were born to be. From her early journey playing music to dropping out of college and starting a branding agency with Ashley Hansberger, Sunny Bunnell has lived an extraordinarily rare life. In this interview episode of Getting Work to Work, Sunny shares about her relentless approach to life and work, why the belief in something to say is more valuable than something to sell, and the importance of owning who you are in a world that wants to tell you who you are and what you can and cannot do. Throughout the interview, Sunny shares about the book she wrote with Ashley, Rare Breed, A Guide to Success for the Defiant, Dangerous, and Different, the seven virtues and vices of being a rare breed, and the unique stories they unearth to help bring the book to life. Show notes and links to resources mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/308. You'll also find links to stream the show on the major podcast platforms and an opportunity to sign up for my email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. Each week, I send out some thoughts on curiosity along with books, videos, podcasts, and other resources blowing my mind as well. Sunny, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here to talk about Rare Breed, A Guide to Success for the Defiant, Dangerous, and Different. But before we get there, what's one thing that everyone should know all about?
What is one thing everybody should know about me, or one thing that everybody should know about the book?
About you. We'll get to the book in a second.
Let's see. What's an interesting fact? I was a prominent bluegrass player by the time I was 11.
Wow.
There's one for you.
Yeah. So what did you play?
Well, I started playing guitar when I was 8, and I grew up around a lot of folk singers and songwriters, all mostly women, in my family and in my extended family. And so I grew up playing music. It was just a big part of who I am and was at that period of time. And so I began, you know, fiddling a little bit with the strings, and then I moved on to other instruments like the dulcimer and the banjo. And then I sort of expanded on from there to like piano and drums. And then I eventually landed in a couple of bands and became a singer. And so it really was just a trajectory of just being in music as part of my path. You know, it was probably the one thing that everybody was like, oh, she's going to be a famous guitarist, you know, that's going to be the path. But no, I didn't do that. I ended up going completely the opposite direction.
Yeah. Why didn't you continue on the music path? Did you just find other amazing things to wrap your mind around?
Yeah, I think I had been doing it for such a long time. You know, I had grown up playing daily and was playing in bars and different shows and, you know, events and things like that from the time I was 14 years old. So I was in literally like bars, you know, from the time I was 14 years old until I probably was 23, 24, and had lived so much life at that point, just all over the place playing. And so I think once I got into a couple of really serious bands that I felt were going to become something, and, you know, like all bands, they're sometimes they just don't work out. And so I just had my heart broken a couple of times, and I was like, I don't think I want to go down this path anymore, even though it was something that is just, it's just like in my DNA. It's just who I am. Mm-hmm. But I eventually, you know, enrolled in college and then dropped out of that to eventually start Motto when I was in my mid 20s. And, you know, music just sort of, it didn't take a backseat, but it certainly, business and entrepreneurship really took more of a center stage for me at that point in my life, and has continued to be that.
Yeah, fascinating. I wonder how much of that music career, you know, I say career just because, I mean, you're on your second career at this point, given all the time that you spent in music. But I mean, what sorts of things did you learn that really paved the way for, you know, dropping out of college and starting Motto?
I think that I grew up with an entrepreneur as a dad. And I witnessed the highs and lows of what it took to run a company and was very close to my father. And so really saw kind of had a front row seat to some of his challenges as an entrepreneur. He started also equally, I think he started with less money than Ashley and I did, but, you know, I watched him, take himself from a coal mining camp, to, you know, no college education to starting one of the what eventually became a very highly successful commercial contracting business on the East Coast. And I sort of watched his trajectory of that. And I think I absorbed some of the lessons that were there. And I probably had entrepreneurship in my blood. Like even looking back being a young, you know, third and fourth grader, there's always a funny story. I don't know if we say this in the book, but I tell this story about how I used to trade my school lunches for Nikes so that I could break dance after school. And so had this kind of like weird entrepreneurship thing going on anyway. So I think that started pretty young. And then of course, watching my dad and my mother do, be entrepreneurs. And then I think it just kind of trickled down to me. And so I began to kind of, as Ashley and I started Motto, I think what we wanted to do was disrupt the mold that we were seeing we started our company in a very small town, in a coastal town in South Carolina, where there weren't a lot of huge agencies. There were only maybe two or three that were dominant at that point. They were all 10 times our size. And we sort of saw what we thought looked a little bit like homogeny across design and decided we're going to tackle it. And that's exactly what we did. So when we started Motto, it was about kind of, we just saw a problem and we were like, hey, I think we can do that differently. And then that really became the model for our own business. And then it sort of took off from there. And of course, lessons learned along the way of just being naive about starting a company with no money, you know, no funding. Everybody is sort of laughing at you and like, who are you, two young girls trying to run an agency? You don't have no design experience, really. You have no background. You have no business acumen. Like, what are you guys thinking? And, you know, we just took that and we were like, wow, we'll show you. And it's exactly, pretty much what we did.
Yeah. So if you didn't have all of those things, you didn't have money, you didn't have experience, what did you have that really shook the status quo to the core?
100% audacity. So we talk about this concept in the book, but audacity is this idea that it can border on being hubristic in some way, where you just sort of believe in yourself and believe in whatever vision it is that you have, that it runs so deep to your core that you will stop at nothing to fully realize it. And again, you know, Ashley and I, coming from the backgrounds that we had, her grandfather started Ram Golf. And, you know, she grew up with a dad that was an entrepreneur and having my dad be an entrepreneur. And we sort of had been born under these sort of wings and then starting Motto at that young age. I had only had experience at that point designing like band posters and logos for different artists and things like that. That was really like the true extent of my experience. And she was pursuing a career in like journalism and English. And so I took her out of college and said, hey, I'm starting this little design business. Do you want to help me? I don't really know what I'm doing, but I think that I think we can make it something pretty amazing. Want to join? And that was really like the beginning of it. And, you know, I think the reality was, is we got our very first client who ended up being what I would call kind of a head of the curve dentist. He was a dentist in the area that had been around the area for a long time and had a reputable name. And he just walked into our office one day, our little tiny office, and he said, hey, I just want to do something really different. You know, all of these dentistries and all of my competitors are basically doing the same thing. We talk about, you know, the way we do things the same way. Like our offices all look the same. We've all bought a very terrible template from this one company. And, you know, I just want to disrupt what, you know, he didn't use the word disrupt at the time, but he said, I kind of want to I want to do something different, I think is what his exact words were. But, you know, he came to us and he said, I think back then you girls are the ones to do it. And we sold him, you know, we sold him on the vision of it. And we had ideas before even what you would see now in most modern dental offices where you go in and you see like they're playing Netflix and there's TVs on the wall and all that. Like back in 2004 and 2005, that was not a common thing that you would see, at least in our area. And so we went in and helped him think about his new office, like how he would, you know, create different offerings for people coming in and how he can make the make it an experience versus just like coming in to, you know, get your teeth clean. Like, how could you come in and make this an actual experience? And we created a new website, did all the signage for the building and helped him think about the office space. And it really took off. And it sort of was like the one thing that I think sort of led us forward, if that makes sense. And we just sold him on this audacious idea that we could do it. And I don't even know if we knew at the time if we could do it, but we just believed that we could. And that was kind of became the thing that I believe really set Motto off and running, was this idea that even if we didn't know how to do it, like we figured it out. And it became sort of the thing that people started to hire us for.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I mean, it really sounds like not only did you sell the dentist on this audacious plan, but it started with actually selling it to Ashley too.
Yeah, this is probably pretty accurate. Yeah, she.
I mean, brilliant.
She was not exactly, you know, persuaded easily, but I think she wasn't really cut out for school either, and I think she was looking. She herself, I think, was searching for what she needed to do. And it just made a lot of sense for us to do it together. I mean, we pretty much at that point, you know, grown up together. I mean, we literally met years before that, went to college together, dropped out together, and then started Motto together. And then now we're writing a book together. So it's sort of like, you know, it just in that way, I think it made sense. Like we just were at a point where we could have gone down very different paths. You know, I could have went down my dream of maybe being a musician, or I think, you know, at that time I was actually thinking about going into vet school and being a veterinarian. And so the fact that we both sort of looked at each other and said, we don't want to do that at all. Let's start a company together. It was a very bold thing for two young women to do at that point with no experience and no money to fund it. It was, I mean, every odd was against us in that way.
What I appreciate too is just the picture that you are painting of how healthy it is to have a creative partner. Mm-hmm. Because in a lot of creative enterprises, it always seems like partnership is, you know, a bad word.
Yeah.
Or a road you just don't go down.
Yeah. I think a lot of what makes a partnership like that work is alignment and values. So what I have seen time and time again, and people that I have known that have started companies with people that they either didn't know that well, or they just simply didn't do enough due diligence on one another to make sure that they were a great fit. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, it came down to trust and alignment on values. You know, Ashley and I thankfully had grown up very similar ways and had watched our families run companies and had seen the highs and lows and also knew what we didn't want in our own company. And so I think there was a little bit of that. And I also think that we were young enough that we just, you know, we were kind of forged in the fire, if that makes sense. Like we just went at it and we stuck together and we tried to sort out our issues. And not to say that there weren't in the very beginning, because we didn't always align. We were always competitive, but then we just got better and older and wiser. And we started to really figure out like where our roles, our strengths and weaknesses really were. And we just knew that we believed in most importantly each other. And I think that's what you have to look for when you're looking for someone to start a company with or to bring into your company. It should not be a decision that you take easily, and it shouldn't be a decision that you rush into or anything along those lines. Like it should be something that you've done a ridiculous amount of due diligence on, because you are kind of inviting that person into your world. And, you know, everything from money to, you know, bad clients to just, you know, companies trying to steal things from you. I mean, like, you know, it's just the reality of running a company, and you have to be able to like have each other's back and really look out for each other in that way. And that's just the reality of any of these types of situations, you know?
So what kept you from quitting when, as you write in the book, the assholes were plentiful and the pain was almost too much to bear?
Yeah. You know, I think that we just really believed in that we had something to say, not just something to sell. Mm-hmm. And
love that.
Yeah. And I think many companies focus on the wrong things. They're thinking about how can I make things faster, leaner, meaner, cheaper? And they're not really worried about substance. And I think that playing the long game means that you have to think about what are you doing this for? Why are you trying to make this business a reality? What is it that you're trying to do for the lives of others? And sometimes we don't ask ourselves that question. And I think what we found was that we had a gift, and it was a raw gift, and it was a little bit of an unhinged gift, but it was a gift nonetheless. And once we could harness that lightning in a bottle, we knew that we could turn it out on the companies and brands that we were working with. And so what we figured out was by not having a rule book, by not having some other founder that we could, you know, or other, all this other agency experience that we could bring to the table, we were sort of like learning through the school of hard knocks. You know, we were getting our, you know, we were bouncing checks, you know, we slept at the office. We experienced a lot of soul crushing defeats. You know, I mean, we were really struggling in the very beginning, but what we learned was that as we worked with leaders and as we worked with organizations, we kind of cracked a code on something that I think a lot of other agencies hadn't gotten hip to at that point. And keep in mind, even back in 2004, 2005, not many agencies even called themselves a branding agency. Everyone, especially in even our town, called themselves either a graphic designer or an advertising agency. There were no branding agencies at all. So when we came out saying we were a branding agency, people didn't even understand what the term actually meant. And so, you know, what I think that you start to learn as you take on really complex problems, and we were, you know, whatever someone put in front of us, we would just bite it. We would sink our teeth right into it and say, we'll do it. We'll take it. We'll sort it out. And so what that taught us along the way was that it wasn't always a branding problem. It was often a leadership problem. And so once we made that connection very early on in our career, much to the sort of confusion of those around us, we would often go in to companies and we would say, it's not your brand, it's your leader, or it's your leadership. And we were just not unafraid to say that. And what we started to then get was, well, we agree with you. How can you fix it? And so that's when we started to figure out a methodology for going into companies and helping them not only articulate that which was often inarticulable, or whatever that word would be, right? I don't even know if that's a word, but like they were unable to articulate certain things for themselves. You know, they were so good at their business, and yet they were often failing at providing the language for the things that they do and who they are. And so once we were able to crack that code, then we were able to say, well, now that we've figured out how to say what you need to say and give you sort of this war cry within your organization, which is kind of what Motto's entire name is built around, is giving companies this war cry, the thing that they can go to battle with every day and they can lead themselves to success. That then became sort of the linchpin for everything else we did. And then we started to connect it to, not only were we able to figure out how to give them that language, but we were also then able to take that language and wrap it up into a brand that they could drive through the culture and through their external deliverables, whether that be, you know, again, the typical things, right? The logo, the website, the way they communicate online, et cetera, et cetera. And so then we became experts at really just figuring out how to tie leadership, culture, and brand, which we called kind of the holy trinity, if you will, of how a brand goes on to greatness. And then it became the linchpin for the concept of Rare Breed, because we realized that some organizations and leaders had this special, unordinary quality. And the ones that did it really, really well, and the ones that could figure out how to do that, were often the exact opposite of everything else around them. And so we began to kind of codify that into the concept of Rare Breed. You know, keep in mind, it took us over a decade to write that book. We were writing that book. Our business and our experience was the blueprint for the book, you know, having done and worked with so many companies as big now as, you know, Hershey's as a client, NFL, you know, E&J Gallo Wines, 20th Century Fox. Like, we have big, big clients now. We also have a lot of disruptive clients as well. And the one thing that we learned was they needed to think a lot differently than everyone around them. And so us bringing that thinking in and saying, how can you be the rare breed in your category? It then mm-hmm. became kind of the hammer to everything that we were doing.
That's spectacular. I mean, when you realize that the problem is leadership, how do you then get through the defenses and barriers and bullshit that comes with leadership at times, you know?
Yeah. I think that it is really about, I believe that it's not necessarily that these organizations are unwilling. It's just that they're bogged down by the amount of structure and process and the levels of leadership that they have put in place to kind of make their lives easier. It actually complicates the process, and they begin to get slow and cumbersome and sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, they're slow like molasses. And so what we have found is they have to start thinking a very different way than they perhaps have become accustomed to. And it means making decisions that are uncomfortable and decisions that go against what everyone at the top rung is saying that they should do. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage. It's a lot easier when you're a younger, more nimble startup to embrace that kind of, you know, symbol on your chest and say, like, throw it at me, I'll take it, because you really have nothing to lose, right? You can take the sword. But for some of these big companies, it's really hard for them. They can't possibly do that. But what we've learned is that there's usually leadership within those divisions that are very innovative. And, you know, even we're working with Hershey's right now, who has an own innovation lab. And what we're finding in those pockets, that we're actually able to make some pretty extraordinary things. So it's going to come down to just, you know, you obviously want to walk them to the ledge and you want them to leap. It's not always successful, but we've had a lot of success coming in and doing that kind of work. And here's the reality, like, they know that they're hiring us for that. It's, you know, we say it in the book, it's like one of the reasons we get hired and sometimes the reason we get fired. They want that thinking, and they want somebody to push them, but sometimes they are unwilling to do that. You know, they love the idea of it, but it just gets like crucified on the altar of ordinary.
Yeah. Oof, what a picture. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So let's talk about Rare Breed, because I had a chance to read an advanced copy of it. And just thank you for writing this book, because I felt like you wrote it for me.
Oh, wow. That's a huge compliment. Thank you.
Yeah. And there were just two quotes in particular that I wrote down that kicked me almost in the face. And they were both in the obsession section.
Okay.
And the first quote was, "Whatever we want from life is only worth what we're willing to pay for it."
Yes, it's a good quote. That is a good quote, isn't it? It's nice hearing someone else like quote it back to me.
Yeah. And then the second one is, "If talent is a knife, comfort is a concrete block that blunts its edge until it can't cut anything."
You want me to speak to that, or?
What I'm blown away by these quotes is that, like, let's take the second one about comfort, for example. Mm-hmm. If you're not continually pushing yourself in these environments, your knife goes dull and you can't do anything.
Right.
And yet, sometimes comfort is one of those things that causes us to slow down, or, you know, take a step back, or, you know, take a moment and be like, oh, okay, we can rest right now. Mm-hmm. So there's a tension there. Like, how do you keep pushing yourself and being that rare breed, and at the same time, I think, make sure your life is in check?
Yeah, I think so. The interesting thing about what we talk about in the book is that these are vices, right? These are traditionally seen in society as vices. So when you talk about the concept of obsession, obsession can lead to things like compulsive behaviors, endless work, burnout, alienation. It is the thing that sort of drives people over the edge. And yet some of the greatest thinkers and creators of all time are probably the most obsessive people in the world. And what is interesting about this is this there's a seductive side to each of these vice virtues. Mm-hmm. We see obsession as a virtue. It's often seen as a vice. How it becomes a vice is that there's these sort of this borderland, right, between light mm-hmm. and dark. And sometimes that is very murky and it can be very indistinct in that you don't know often what's what. We can use the flag of, oh, I'm just being obsessed or I'm OCD, mm-hmm. when in fact it's paralyzing behavior and your teammates, let's just say you're in a company and you just can't get things done because you obsess over the details and they pull it from your fingers essentially because you mm-hmm. can't quite let it go. You know, mm-hmm. that becomes destructive. But obsession harnessed in the most powerful ways of where it really becomes a part of who you are. You squeeze every ounce of talent out of yourself. You are able to make sure that when you put something out into the world, that it really has, like, you're willing to put your name on it. You're willing to put your stamp on it mm-hmm. because that is everything, you know? And if yeah. you put out shoddy work and you're putting out things that are rushed and half-baked and not really thought through, like, it's a reflection on you. It's a reflection mm-hmm. on your character. So we really believe that harnessing that part of it is very important and knowing how to use it as an advantage, as a thing that can awaken potential is actually a very powerful tool. The key here, I think, is understanding when you've tipped over into the dark side and when you've actually, when you're on the light side of the coin and where you, how to balance that, you know, if you will. And it's very difficult to do. That's why we talk about it in the book. We talk about the light side of this and the dark side of that and what those two things mean and why they can be destructive if they're sort of unchecked or uncalibrated. And so mm-hmm. when you think about obsession in that way, that's absolutely a big part of what we're talking about. And I think you had said something earlier about this idea of like sacrifice. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of times you will sacrifice sleep and eating or drinking or, you know, I mean, there's been times where we have worked all day and all night and didn't stand up one time. And a lot of people, especially those people who are really into like work-life balance, are probably cringing as I'm saying this. But when you love something as deeply as it becomes a part of you, who you are and your identity, you are willing mm-hmm. to sacrifice for it. And I do think that greatness can come out of it, but it can also, as I said, be very destructive. And that's why we talk about the vice and the virtue aspect of each one of those seven vices, because it really is important to understand how to take what is a vice and actually make it a virtue.
That's powerful. Mm-hmm. Super powerful. And I'm curious which virtues you identify most with.
So we have a quiz that we created. We worked with someone who is a psychologist and a professor to actually create this. We said, well, how does somebody find out like what their dominant vice is? And so we created this quiz and it's at rarebreedquiz.com, but you can actually figure out what your actual vice is. And so what we learned was that sometimes you're kind of a little bit of each one of these things, but there's usually one that's very dominant in your profile. And so for me, it was audacity, which sounds just about right. I took it 2 or 3 times and I just kept coming out with audacity. And I was like, all right, that sounds about right. And my second close one was obsession. And then Ashley, I believe, was emotional, which is very, very much in line with her. And her secondary was hypnotic, which is, if you know her, you would know that that's very true. And if you know me, you would be like, yes, audacity and obsession are definitely Sunny 1000%. So
that's awesome. I love the fact that you created a quiz on this with a psychologist. I mean, that almost speaks to being the rare breed as well. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. When we came up with the idea, I was like, wouldn't it be cool if we, you know, Ashley and I were sitting around and some of our best ideas we have when we're driving in the car, like when we've hit a wall with something, we'll just say, do you want to take a drive? And so we'll get in the car and we were driving around and, you know, we were talking about how could other people figure out what vice and virtue they are. And so mm-hmm. that's exactly what we did. We said, how can we create a series of questions that would be fun to take and you wouldn't really be able to identify or sort of point out which one, you know, based on your answer you would end up being, which was kind of one of the tricks that we wanted to play was We wanted to make sure that people couldn't just look at the question and the answer and be like, oh, that's like a rebellious answer, or that's a, right, you know, obsession answer and things like that. And so the original quiz, I believe, was like 14 questions. And then I said, it's just not deep enough and it's not thorough enough. And so we bumped it up to 28 because it'd be seven each. And mm-hmm. so now it's 28 questions. It's very thorough. We've tested it now on hundreds of people. And I'll see sometimes we'll get the statistics of back of people who have started to take it. And every now and then I'll see like a friend of mine that will come through and take the test. And mm-hmm. having known them, whether I've known them as a childhood friend or, you know, I've known them as a colleague or whatever, I'll see that it's pretty damn spot on. I've yet to see anyone take it where I'm like, that's not Glenn. You know what I mean? Like, and you, it is like, you know, it is. So it's really cool to kind of see that, to see that the work that we did, I mean, we worked on it for months and months and months and just released it a couple weeks ago. And just mm-hmm. to see the people taking it and then some of the responses that we've been getting has been really, really cool to see that, because we've now, you know, you can share your results and say like, I'm audacious. And then it tells you at the end of the quiz, like in a pretty detailed format, what the qualities of, let's just say, being hypnotic and what that really means to be hypnotic in your mm-hmm. life and your work and your career, your business. What are the qualities that you possess when you are hypnotic in your career? And then it talks about what is the dark side of that? Like what happens when it kind of goes off the chain and you become someone who's using your charisma and your hypnotism for deceit? Mm. We can see that happening right now. We've got many, many people in the world, as you probably know, some of our most gifted orators throughout time have mm-hmm. been some of the most charismatic, mm-hmm. amazing people that you're like, what? You know, like these people are persuasive and mm-hmm. engaging, and yet they are master manipulators. And mm-hmm. they are the dark side of what we're talking about. So mm-hmm. just because you are that thing doesn't mean that you're utilizing it in the right way or using it for good. And so that's really what the book is, to teach you how to do those, to do those yeah. things.
And one of the ways that you really do that is by using some really awesome stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the stories that you tell in this book because they're not the same kind of tired examples about Southwest Airlines that you read in every business book.
And we wanted to be the anti that.
Yes, thank you. I mean, how did you curate and discover these new stories?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it was, so we had a very backwards way of backing into some of these stories. It's so strange. Some of the earlier iterations of us doing this, believe it or not. So at the time that Ashley and I started writing it, we were actually in Dallas and we had been there for about a year and we started to curate some of the ideas. And so we would go to the Dallas Public Library and we would just like pull out books and, you know, like dog ear certain things. And then we'd write things down on note cards. And what's kind of funny is, so right now we're in the pre-order window for the book. And one of the things that we're giving away, if you actually order the book now, between now and September 3rd, we're actually giving away, if you order a certain amount of books, we're giving away those actual note cards where we took an idea and like wrote something down where we found a story and we were like, oh, that's so interesting. And then we would like write our notes down. And so we're giving some of those away. But a lot of it was just like, we would come across it. We would be sitting next to somebody in a bar and they'd start talking about a story and we'd be like, that's fascinating. And then we just like jot stuff down, and that literally became how we sort of pieced some of the stuff together. But most of it was, there had to be a certain criteria. You know, it had to be a story that was not sort of overdone, over abused. There needed to be, you know, in some scenarios, we do talk about people that, you know, like we talk about Lena Dunham, for example, you know, mm-hmm. the director and actress in Girls. And, you know, we briefly touch on Lady Gaga. I mean, there's definitely people in there that anyone reading the book would recognize, but most of the stories that we've curated are sort of unique things that maybe somebody hasn't heard before, or they're an interesting take on a concept that may have been around for a long time, but had never been applied in a business context. And so mm-hmm. that was kind of the criteria for how we created and crafted some of the stories. And so when you open the book and you actually look at the chapters, they're not like chapter one, you know, how to be a great leader. Right. It's like chapter one, fuck norms. So it's,
I mean, it's, that hooked me immediately.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and then you're like, oh, chapter 13, massage the octopus. Like, what the fuck are they even saying? And so it's kind of like one of those things where you just like, you don't know what the stories are really about until right. you actually read them. But when you think about the way that the stories are applied to your life, your career, and your work, and just your personal development as a human being, you'll mm-hmm. find that these little, we call them mantras, if you will, but they're like mm-hmm. life mantras that you can think about and apply in every situation that you're in. For example, we talk in the book about one of the chapters is called Violate Etiquette. And it's mm-hmm. about how oftentimes we see things or are part of things that are not really, what's the word, proper. You know, they're not, sometimes we look the other way. And we tell a story about a conference call that we were on with a potential client where the person on that call started what I don't want to use this word very lightly, but he was being very derogatory to mm-hmm. his executive brand manager / marketing assistant. And it was one of those calls where you've been on those calls before and you're like, is this just awkward? Or is this like unprofessional, like what I'm witnessing right now? And you know, you're in a prospect call. I mean, this could have been, I think this client could have been maybe a $200,000 job for us. And you're sitting on this call and you're like, I'm pretty sure that this guy is completely out of line. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we've all done this where we just smile and continue on with the call. And we know damn well that the call is awkward or something's not right. Or, you know, this person is being derogatory towards us or to someone on their team. And we tolerate it. And this chapter is about digging deep and not like turning your cheek and looking the other way. It's mm-hmm. about saying something. Mm-hmm. And so many of us don't, you know, so many people are in these situations and they don't speak up. And it's really a chapter about that. And what does it mean when you speak up? You know, yeah. Of course you're going to get backlash. You know, not everybody's going to agree with what you're going to say. And, you know, we ended that call. Like we ended that call probably 6.5 minutes into a call that should have been, I think was slotted for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is you'll have to read what happens, you know, by the woman that was on the receiving end of that. But,
yeah.
You know, it was a moment that we hung up the phone and we sat back and we were like, that was the right thing to do. We violated etiquette. And sometimes that is the right thing to do. And I think we just don't think about it enough. So it's just like little lessons like that, that you can just apply to everyday situations, both in work and life and in your career and everything that you're doing to become a better person at whatever it is that you're doing, whether you're in film or you're a designer or you're a CEO. We've even had, I had someone that's a hairdresser tell me that she read parts of the book and was like, I'm trying to do something different in my life. I want to do hair for these types of people. And, you know, I'm trying mm-hmm. to get ahead in my career. And like everything that you guys said, like it just really resonated with me and I felt like it applied. I'm like, wow, that's so interesting. Cause you know, we wrote it kind of for a specific audience, right? Like a young leader, entrepreneur, mm-hmm. Somebody who's in personal development, you know, but then mm-hmm. we've gotten people from all walks of life who are saying, you know, that aren't CEOs and aren't necessarily entrepreneurs by definition, but they're learning lessons and things that they can apply to their life from this book. And that's super cool to hear.
Yeah. Well, I think what it speaks to is people are hungry for a voice who's willing to not only give great advice, but tell the stories of like, you know what, we had $200,000 on the line and we knew we needed to speak up. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not done every day. I mean, that is rare, for lack of better words.
Yeah, no, it really is. And I think we've done that many times in our career, much to the dismay of other people. You know, I remember having a mentor who was like, you just take the money, just do the job and take the money. Mm-hmm. And I understood what he was saying. And he said, you know, you're not going to like everybody you work with. You're not going to agree with everybody you work with. And I'm like, I know that. Like, I understand that. I've been in business, you know, now for more than a decade. I get the concept, mm-hmm. but you don't have to work with somebody that you don't want to. and that you feel will drag you through the mud or make you feel less than, that is not a position that anybody should willingly put themselves in. For the sake of money, there's not enough money you could buy me with to try to get me to be in a room with somebody that is just going to be derogatory to me or my team, or that's not a world that I would like to be in. And so sometimes we do make those tough calls, you know. Now when you're young and you're starting out, I mean, there's a lot of jobs that we took that we didn't, because we were so young and naive, there were a lot of jobs that we took just to pay the bills. And we didn't realize at the time how to actually have the tools to distinguish between a good fit and a bad fit. So that's something I think that is actually really important. And we talk a little bit about this in the book too, but you know, when you're starting out in any journey or whatever career that you're on, you have to find partnerships that uplift you and support you. And again, back to this idea of like-mindedness and values and being aligned there. When you are not aligned in those things, it makes for a hurricane of a situation. It's a tsunami you do not want to be in front of. And so I have learned, you know, and both Ashley and I have learned over many, many years, I think, of how to now sort of identify and sense and read the room about whether or not this is a good fit for us from a business standpoint. And it becomes like a set of criteria that you have, like almost like a mental checklist that you're going through, and you're just as they're evaluating you as the right partner for their agent, you know, their company or their organization, for their brand or whatever it is that you're working on. You know, it could be anything, right? Like you're designing a logo, you're designing a website, like they're evaluating you, but you need to be evaluating them just as much. And you don't have to let on that you're evaluating, but you should have a set of criteria that you're benchmarking against. Like, what are your non-negotiables? What will you do and not do? What will you tolerate and not tolerate? And I think that's really important in any career that you're in. What are you willing to do and what are you willing to not do? And you should know where that line is for yourself, because it will make for a better, you know, for yourself to feel better about your own spirit. I think we say in the book, like, you can get another job. You can't get another soul.
That's awesome. Whew. So how can people who are willing to pay the price become rare breeds?
Well, it's an interesting story that we've been asked is, can anyone be a rare breed? And I think the answer is maybe. Because rare breeds, I think, are in fact rare. You know, if you look at the true definition of what a rare breed is, it's an ordinary among their kind. They're not plentiful. They're not everywhere. They're not, you know, just like in a plethora of accessibility. I think the truth is that they are everywhere. You just may or may not know it. And I think the one difference between them is that while others sort of suppress this quirky, oddball, if you will, pain in the ass qualities, like rare breeds really lean into theirs. They sort of let them off the leash to break tradition and run like hooligans and just sort of, you know, attack the status quo. And really, when you think about it, like owning yourself in this way, it really can hurt like hell. And the rare breed life, I think, is not one of least resistance. I think it's very difficult and not everyone is cut out for it. I think the difference between somebody who has become a rare breed and someone who's not is a lot of people have these qualities. They've just never awakened them. Now, keep in mind that all throughout our life, I can think back to when I was a young kid, and I'm sure you can too. How many people have you had in your life who told you that you couldn't do something or that you shouldn't do something, or they doubted you, or they said that that's not a, you shouldn't be a dancer. Like, we're all, you know, lawyers, like you need to be a lawyer. It's the responsible thing to do. So you've heard this, right? We've heard this throughout our whole life, you know, whether it's friends, teachers, mentors, maybe our own voices. We tell ourselves these things. We tell ourselves these lies that we are less than in some way, or we're not capable of doing the impossible. And what I've learned by writing this book and what I've learned throughout my career, and especially working with all types of leaders. I mean, keep in mind, we've worked with hundreds of organizations at this point, some phenomenal, some not so phenomenal, some that I felt like had all of the qualities of something that could be special, and their own internal politics kind of just burn the flame out. And then, you know, I think the difference is that some people stay silenced forever. You know, they hear this one code of doubt or one whip of doubt, and they sort of like believe it, and it becomes the dialogue that they have and becomes the dialogue for their life. And so they don't chase down their passion like it's the last bus of the night. They don't chase down the things that truly make them come alive. And I believe that the difference between somebody who's a rare breed and somebody who's not is that they've tapped into that. They have found that there is something in them that they have really doubled down on. And it becomes maybe the thing that opens the door for them, maybe opens many doors. And they also, maybe if they're young and they're sort of, you know, still getting their legs, they will sometimes use that and it will close doors as well, because they haven't quite figured out the balance of how to make that vice into a virtue. But once you do, once you unlock that, I think that you can absolutely do and be anything. And that's really the potential of rare breed, is that it is for people who have been in a world that has wanted to own you, and you're saying, no, I'm going to own who I am, and I'm going to make that kind of the catalyst for my career. And so it's really about that. And so, yeah, I mean, can anyone be a rare breed? Maybe.
Yeah. So as you think about your journey from musician to brand agency owner to author to whatever you would label yourself today, how would you describe your madness and lust for life?
Relentless. And painful. It's been a hard journey. I think when you live this way and you are this way and you are fierce in every sense of the word, whatever it is that you do, you know, you love hard, you cry hard, you work hard, like everything you do is like, it's the extreme of what maybe others do and experience and feel. I think when you live that way, you are just a relentless human being, and it comes with some anguish, you know, there's no doubt about it, but it also can come with a lot of greatness too. So it's, again, you know, what, back to the sort of concept of the book again, is this thesis of how to own who you are in a world that wants to tell you that you're not the things that you should be or could be. And so, like I said, it hurts like hell, but if you can sort of adopt some of these philosophies and you can think about your career and your life in this way, I do think that it can be a pretty amazing journey too, because you're unafraid to just jump in. You're willing to take the leap, whether the net's there or not.
So when life hurts and you sit down, you pick up your guitar, what song just do you start playing that immediately soothes the soul?
Don't Think Twice, It's All Right by Bob Dylan.
Nice. Oh, nice. Do your fingers just automatically go to all the right notes when you're playing?
No. I mean, it's a familiar landscape to me, right? You know, strings and the guitar and the neck are it's like, even if I haven't touched a guitar for a year, I could reach out my hand and somebody hand me a guitar and it will always feel like my hands were meant to be there.
Nice.
It's just a connection in a land that I know inside and out, eyes closed, eyes open. I just know that. I know that territory. I know that terrain. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, I'm a songwriter, so I've written many, many songs over the years, but you know, there's always like a song that comes to you or that is a favorite to play and things like that. But you know, I've got a crazy eclectic playlist, you know, I mean, it's pretty intense. Like the range of music that I'll listen to, you know, everything from country to old jazz to, you know, really deep, deep, like Gullah folk that people are like, what in the hell is this song? And you're like, just shut up and listen. But you know, some people don't feel it that way. They don't know that. And it is a very specific type of music, you know, especially like, I can't even hear. It was so funny, back in Dallas a couple of years ago, I was walking down, Ashley and I were coming back from, I don't know, we went to get like an ice cream or something silly. And there was an old man and his wife, and he was playing the harmonica, and he was playing an old gospel hymn on the harmonica, and he, it literally felt like a knife had went through my soul. Cause like, I just feel that music so deeply because it's how I grew up. And so when I think of that music, right, like that music, you know how like music defines certain periods of your life, that kind of music is so, so spiritual to me. It speaks to me in a lot of different ways. And so it just kind of pierced me like a knife. And I immediately felt myself like starting to well up. Like Ashley will always be like, you're such a, like, you need to man up. Cause like, cause I like started crying and she's like, right. She's like, it's just a harmonica. But you know, it was funny because like I had to stop him and I needed to get the story. And he said he was playing the harmonica for his wife because his wife was like down. He was trying to find the car. They had lost the car and he was trying to, he had kind of wandered off from her and he was playing the harmonica so she could hear where he was at.
Oh my gosh.
And it was just, they had been together for such a long time and there was this beautiful story. And he was telling me how he'd like, you know, they played in this little church and he invited me to come and sit around with them and play. And it was just the coolest thing. Cause I had, you know, I don't experience those kinds of things. Like if you've grown up in around like I did, I grew up pretty poor until I was like 8 or 9 years old and my family moved out. But like, you know, I grew up in a very sort of oppressed situation. And so when you grow up in that and you are around that kind of music and that music is the way that you tell your story, it's like, you don't often get into, you know, those types of scenarios as often as you would, you know, like going into a bar and they're just playing like Lynyrd Skynyrd or, you know, it's just kind of the usual, right? Whereas like this was extremely unordinary and kind of, once in a lifetime kind of scenarios where I will find myself either connecting with somebody or listening to someone that knows that style of music and that genre and who has grown up playing it similar to I have. And so that's a very rare connection indeed. So for him to have been wandering around and like playing the harmonica so his wife could find them, it was just unbelievable. You know, it was just really cool. So yeah, it's things like that are kind of special.
I can't think of a better title to this episode than just shut up and listen, because it speaks to almost everything, not just listening to a man playing the harmonica for his wife, but listening to yourself as well on this journey of life. I mean, thank you. I mean, you've just blown my mind in so many ways. And so how often do you blow your own damn mind, as you affectionately write in the book about blowing your own damn mind?
Oh gosh, all the time, you know, like... Like, for example, I blew my mind the other day when I couldn't get the Keurig to work. And I'm like, wow, you are so pretty, you know, like for the rest of your life, you're sort of talented. Like you can play anything with a string and yet you can't figure out a Keurig. Like that's exactly what's going on. So that blew my own damn mind. I'm like, you know, so it's things like that. Like it's just ordinary dumb stuff where I'm like, wow, you're really, really looking good today.
Well, Sunny, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to just talk about the book, talk about your life. And the last question that I have for you was, what was the last book or podcast that blew your mind?
Let's see. What was a good one that I've just recently listened to? I really like the book. It's Ethan Hawke's book. I want to say it's like Rules of a Night. Or Rules for a Night or something like that. I don't know the exact title, but I'll send it off to you. Okay. I read that and I was not only was I pretty impressed by his writing, but I was really impressed that it was Ethan Hawke. I was like, wow, that's really, really surprising and really cool. And like the content was actually really interesting. So, you know, I read a lot of poets like Charles Bukowski and Richard Brautigan and a lot of poets that probably people haven't heard of, but a lot of people know Bukowski. But I was just surprised to see such a deep piece of writing by that, you know? So it's cool to kind of see, just find a little surprise like that and be like, wow, that was a really cool read. And it's a small little book. I think it's like small and green and, it's not very thick and it's just kind of a pocket book, but it's really, really cool. So you should check that out.
Excellent. Will do.
Yeah, cool.
Well, Sunny, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing just the book being released in September, to see all of the shenanigans that you go on to do with releasing a book like this. And I hope it's an unbelievable success for both you and Ashley.
Oh man, thank you so much. I mean, it's been one heck of a wild ride, you know, the book itself and how it came to be and the story behind it. And so there's a lot of really cool things that if people want to check it out at thisisrarebreed.com. We're obviously on Instagram at thisisrarebreed. And then you can also check out our agency at We Are Motto. But if you go to thisisrarebreed.com/bonuses or thisisrarebreed.com/street team, we've got little lines out where we're trying to get people to get on and help us get the message out. Because, you know, so far we're kind of just, you know, getting some rumblings of people that have gotten their hands on it on an early copy. And, you know, we're getting such amazing feedback. And so it would just be amazing to have, as many people probably listening to this know, it's just so hard to get a book out anyway. Yeah. And just to kind of get people to really like love what we've written. That's so much of it. And just like really believing in the message and just being able to like tell their friends and tell people and just being willing to kind of be a megaphone for us in a way is we could use it all the help that we can get to get that message out there. So this was one of the things that we were really excited to be a part of to get the, you know, get a little bit of Rare Breed out there in these, you know, before the book goes on sale.
I hope that you will take a moment to take the quiz, Rare Breed quiz, to know which Rare Breed virtue you identify with the most. For me, I took the quiz twice and both times came up with rebellious, and I can definitely see how that is both a virtue and a vice in my life. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.